what comes up is the inscriptorian. So we've got to go to an actual fitting of wake. Now, I wonder why she would, you know, One-Eyed Monster, that's the cover of Culture's Our Business. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, in a way, that's actually a yin-yang, because you've got the white guy with the eye patch with one eye and the black guy with the eye patch with one eye on the front and back covers.
Right. Well, it's, remember, Phineas Wake is hard to find nowadays, right? It's a little screwed up. But I'm trying to get, okay, so give me a index. Nah, it doesn't. There's no search mechanism for Phineas Wake. Do you know how to get one?
I've got one bookmarked somewhere, but it would take a while to get to.
Well, we have to find out. I mean, it'd be interesting if this is actual Marshall writing and not quotation. So find your Phineas Wake manuscript, which has a search mechanism.
Yeah, I'll just push pause on the tape, Bob.
Okay. Let me know.
Yep, I'm letting you know, Bob. We've just resumed after an extensive period of searching around to find out whether this language that we've encountered is actually to be found in Finnegan's Wake, and we've come up with nothing.
Right, so we look at turd that turned hairy in identity quest. So he always looked at violence as an identity quest. Turd that turned hairy. Mrs. Smogbutts went into retrograde and turned turtle. That's hurt my feelings. For somatic, bodily, that's like chemical body somnambules, in Dumpus Mud of Quadrangly Miasma.
It's a nice phrase.
Quadrophenia. Chemical bodies in Dumpus Mud of Quadrophenia, the Sisquipulin Bog of the Labyrinth. Yeah. New grammar for new garbage. So he's saying that his sentences are the grammar for the new garbage? That the way he wrote about this is the grammar?
I don't know. I'll have to work that one through.
Yeah, new grammar. So is he presenting new garbage and she responds, and the new grammar is one's feelings? You determine what's grammatically correct or not based on what your feelings are, whether you're insulted or not. But smog, miasma, dumpus mud, somnambula, bog. This is the, you quoted it recently. What's he saying about speech? The high vistas, the high something of the swamp, mafia-ridden swamp, when he talks about ancient acoustic space.
Yep.
In Counterblast, what's the phrase? Well, so what's interesting is he talks in about 1970, the garbage apocalypse. But it's a bog, a swamp. Do they give a date? Doesn't give a date other than it's a 1970 book, right? We don't have a date on this letter. But it is in around 1970s when you start using the phrase garbage apocalypse. So you have smog and bog are the muddy wake. You have to probe through this with a tactile antenna.
Yeah, the Sesquipulan bog. It's a really complex situation.
Is it a real word? If you look up Sesquipulan, you get something.
It's a modification of sesquipedalian.
And what does that mean?
Essentially, it means given to using long words or words containing many syllables.
Okay, well, what I like is his terms for this is the planet Pluto.
Yep.
People are starting to see in the information overload, they're getting bogged down and turning turtle and somnambulisting and getting into muddy miasma. Okay, that's interesting, sort of. Look at the comments. Evan Leatherwood says, McLuhan once compared the university, which is blended with the modern service environment of the city. Yeah, that's right. McLuhan, the university is the new city. He compared the university to a cyclops or minotaur, because when the figure joins with the ground, you get a monster. Very good. That's true. Perhaps he made a similar remark about the Arts and Letters Club. Yeah, that sounds good. And then some Andrew answers, perhaps, jeers. No, that's a knowledgeable person, Evan Leatherwood.
Mm.
Those are factors that I was thinking about as I wondered about this. But he's reminding me of what McLuhan said, you know, the figure becomes a monster. He was probably talking technically, and the person thought he was insulting an institution.
Okay, let's go through those words again that he uses. I think it's quite interesting.
Oh, yeah, you mean the phrases?
Yeah, yeah. What he's using.
Okay, in the 10th Thunder, Finney's Wake, page 424, the thunder begins, hello, turd. All right?
Yeah.
Hello, turd. Mighty, and then he has it Warm Peace in Global Village. When he's talking about that particular, or quoting Eric, doing the actual thunder, the 10th Thunder, he calls it Mighty Wake, I think.
Yeah, I guess, so, yeah. And the other context I think he uses turd is in terms of the process of art, where the artist takes garbage and, you know, shits it out, and, you know, that sort of the gold shit dialectic.
Yeah, and around 1970, it became a popular phrase, getting your shit together. Everybody knew they were in a bog and tactilely probing through the bog, and it was all a swamp of shit. And so they were getting, pattern recognition was getting your shit together into a rearview mirror coherency. So actually these words, bog, dump, miasma, smog butts, fits turd, the first word.
Yep. So turd, like a turd that turned hairy, is like this shit got crazy.
Could it be anthropomorphic? The turd turned into a woman with lots of hair.
Oh, yeah, possibly. Who knows?
Yeah, in the information environment, men are doing surveillance. And then this woman happened to be caught in the middle of the daily surveillance done by men. And so the turd turned hairy. Anyways, it's a good example of McLuhan's crazy mind from reading Finnegan's Wake. I mean, his playing with puns and that. This is the most blatant example. So it's a good find by Andrew McLuhan.
Yeah, it's a nice variation on where we get those little notes where it's in the calculus of center margins, figure without ground, this, that, and the other thing. And so he's moving to a different kind of notation as he's working things through.
Yeah, he's becoming a Finnegan. He's practicing, creating his own Finneganese.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think that's it, right? We're ready to go to the last one.
Okay, let's see what he's got there.
Again, it's not coming through, so you'll have to send it to me. Oh, no, I clicked on it and it came through for some reason. Is that, well, let's see. Do this.
Yep, November. It's the last one, November 25, 2011.
Okay, very good. And here it is, December. Maybe he's not going to do it anymore. Ex Libris, Marshall McLuhan. Well, he's doing like one item a month. And it's September 27th, October 13th, November. He's tending to go in the latter part of the month. So we have a long wait before anything will show up. And maybe he'll have the alibi of Christmas and not do anything till the new year. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We can only hope, Andrew. Okay, so, just for the record, we're coming up to the end of the centenary year, I have said, I ain't talking about McLuhan ever again. And might tolerate a little croaker, but you ain't going to get much talk of McLuhan from me after this. I've laid out the course. Well, that's sort of one aspect of what's happening with Myron, is I end up explaining a lot, and you the old McLuhan explanations, or explaining McLuhan, and not too keen on it, but he's drawing me back, and he's getting he's finding it very profitable. Like the basic stuff, like ABC of McLuhan, he's finding he doesn't have that, so he's getting good insights. But I don't want to do it too much longer. I'm on to completing McLuhan. I think I should be mulled over now. No more mulling over of McLuhan. So this is a long thing, so let's see what it is. I'll let you read it, Andrew.
Yeah, this is I think I've just scanned through it, and there's not too much in here for anybody, I think. So I thought I would share some of Marshall McLuhan's signatures.
No. The title is Ex Libris Marshall McLuhan. It's dated November 25th, 2011.
Yeah, we already said that. So I thought share some of Marshall McLuhan's signatures with you. Marshall signed his name in many of his books.
What? We're going to look at his signatures?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Let me see. I'm going to read this, Andrew. We're going to get through this fast. I thought I would share some of Marshall McLuhan's signatures with you. Marshall signed his name in many of his books. Early on in his time at the University of Manitoba and also at Cambridge, he would include more information. In these photos, you can see several things. Marshall varied his signature from M. McLuhan to H. M. McLuhan to H. M. McLuhan without the dots to Marshall McLuhan. Let's look at that. M. McLuhan, H. M., there they are. And that's early. That's in the 30s. Well, it's interesting to know how he regarded himself when he dropped the H.M. In his university days, he generally included additional information such as school and program, and more often in England, the place he bought the book. Sometimes a bookseller's invoice is tucked in between the pages. I suspect there were several reasons Marshall put his name in the books he purchased. He would lend them out on occasion, so he wanted to make sure people knew whose book it was. I'm sure also some sort of pride of ownership played a role. It is very convenient for me and future researchers that Marshall McLuhan's handwriting changed over the years. Because of that, we can ballpark date much of his annotation/marginalia. Because of that, we can track his changing interests, his intellectual development. For example, we can look at a book which he purchased in England in 1935 and made notes in over the years. Marshall's library was a working library. He went back to his books and made new insights each time. So we can see what was notable to him in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, etc. Indeed, sometimes he would write a note about this change. In one volume, he wrote in the early 30s a few short sentences on morality and added a postscript a few years later with some embarrassment for his earlier thought. As I am almost at the end of my initial catalog of the library and have a fairly good sense of the artifact as a whole, so many implications are becoming clear which I would not have imagined, such as being able to get a sense of intellectual development and many other things which I hope to post about and share in the future. I look forward to that. Thanks for reading, Andrew. So this turned out to be interesting how he takes these signatures. I retract my flippancy.
It's going to be good to see the fruits of that labor, because it is an interesting project.
Yeah, it's interesting. He can go back and see the writing style and then figure out when the statements were written. So it says, thanks for reading, Andrew Crystal. And then it says, excuse me, as a postscript, last week I was in Porto Alegre, Brazil for a conference with Eric McLuhan and was asked to give a small presentation on the work I've been doing with Marshall's library. Though I had to throw it together last minute, I spoke for over an hour about the experience and implications for a scholarship. It was very satisfying for me personally, and I'd like to thank the amazing people at PUCRS, which is Eduardo Campos Palanda, in Carlos Garbaza, in Magda Juliana. Oh, these are the people. That was an address. Amazing people at PUCRS. We don't know what that is, right? Eduardo Campos Palanda, Carlos Gabazzi, Andrew Crystal, Magda, and Juliana. You do get around, Andrew. All the other staff and students who welcomed us and were so accommodating, they're mentioned anonymously. I'm hoping to make more presentations in the future to share this resource and to fund further my research. If your institution would be interested in having me present, do get in touch. Thanks again, Andrew. So, he's gone commercial. He's sold out.
Well, who knows? Who knows what he's what his larger project is?
I was just joking. I think I was joking. But what's the grievance? So here's a comment from someone who was a student, PhD student in Brazil. Congratulations on your initiative. It was great to have them here in Brazil with us and be able to. It was great to have them here in Brazil with us and be able to exchange experiences. So cool. Maybe this is a text message, you know, the grammar, no punctuation. Are always welcome, and continue your search with this interesting search, Andrew. Can be sure that it will still bring you many joys and many exciting experiences. And that's from Pollyanne Marie Espindola, PhD student in communication. Oh, and then Andrew writes, thanks, Pollyanne. It was such a pleasure. Then Sue writes, your father, Eric, could have written the Trinity Hall signature. That means Eric writes similarly? Is that what it means? Yeah, that's September 35. Yeah. So it looks like Eric's writing. And then Terry Mockler says, good luck with this endeavor, Andrew. I've been in the coach house at a certain era when most of his books had already been removed and had been in the McLuhan archive at the U of T. Not much there either. Very glad to see all the new life added to his work cropping up. Big man, big influence. Over and out. That's Terry Markler in Delray Beach, Florida. Andrew says, thank you, Terry, and thanks for reading. Well.
And that was that. And that was that.
That came to a rather a slow breaking.
Breaking. We didn't get a lot out of these last few posts, Paul.
Nope. Not like the early days, man. No. We were just going for hours.
Oh, I think we had better posts to work with, or at least more materials to work with.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be more materials. We've got 4,000 books here. I mean, skimpy. Now, he didn't have time, I guess, to do this. But maybe he will continue it, and we will be justly rewarded by our continuing fetish of coming back to this site.
Yeah, it's quite interesting after finishing Mum that this feels quite puny. Like, had I encountered this a few years ago, I would have been quite taken with it, but it's...
You reached the heights with Mum.
Yeah, we did a good job, you know. We
yeah. And you're quite proud of it. You mentioned to me the other day. I noted that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun, and I think we created a great resource for people to go back and listen to. But I think also we pointed out really clearly where McLuhan ceases to be useful in terms of the present. Possibly still as a foundational kind of thing, but... it's necessary to move beyond him.
Yeah, we did 33 episodes. One of them was 2 hours, and most of them were 3, 4, 5 hours. That's 150 hours. It's a course. I mean, maybe even 2 semesters of course. Well, what is it? How many hours in a course, say, in a 3-month course? You do an hour, you know, hour a week?
Your average class at the moment in the New Zealand situation is 12 weeks long, and they will have approximately 3 hours of contact time a week. So
36 hours.
Yep.
And we did 90 hours.
Yep, of contact time. Yes.
Wow. That's, would you call it contact time?
Yeah.
Okay, that's chemical body contact.
Yes.
Look at that. What is three semesters? A year and a half? Or is that considered a year?
Three semesters, you'd probably do... Well, your three semesters is 1 year.
Okay, so we presented a whole course and with lots of surprises on our sources. We even presented Marshall McLuhan, just for the record. He showed up. And Corinne came in a little later and scolded everybody and corrected Marshall. It turns out Corinne is the hidden ground here.
So what is the future of Marshall McLuhan, Bob, in the wake of this centenary? What do you anticipate is going to happen to his public figure? Are we going to see more stamps? Are we going to see more Copelands? Or how are people going to respond and deal with him now?
Is McLuhan a stamp? That sounds familiar now. A few years ago, he became a Canadian stamp, like James Joyce did in Ireland.
Yep, and Douglas Copeland produced that big sort of large postage stamp recently under the guise of a biography.
So McLuhan's already a museum, a terrible fate. He did not become as anti-environmental as he hoped to be. His tenure as around the environment did not have any long-term staying power. Not like Wyndham Lewis. Wyndham Lewis still, well, no, this year, last couple of years, they are beginning to celebrate Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, so.
So it's only Joyce has got the kick from the university scene.
What'd you say? Do that again?
It's only Joyce that has got the kick from the university scene.
Right. McLuhan will be part of the university scene, if not now. Wyndham Lewis won't. So since the university is the city, then Wyndham Lewis remains the long-ranging, longest-running anti-environment. And I think the issues, that Lewis represents, we've come to a kind of end time. Time has ended. Space has ended. The issues that people were concerned about. Here's an interesting thing. What was it now? The Evergreens. And I've talked to Marshall McLuhan through the Evergreens. They made a very interesting point that in the middle of the 20th century, people were nervous about technology. But now, and this was said in the 90s, as moved into digital technology, people did not find technology a threat anymore. They had gotten used to it or found it friendly. So the whole argument, the worrying about technology is gone, the ground for that. Yes. And that's what, and you note when Eric gives his talks, a couple of talks we've seen at Media College events, and he talks about we've got to learn to turn off certain environments, it's silly. That solution. We must look at our technologies and study them and decide whether we're going to use them or not. That seems real ancient. I mean, do you think anything is not going to be used now?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I have trouble even using the word technology now because, like, where does technology start and where does technology end? And, you know, that's... I mean, McLuhan, I think one of his services was pointing out that the end of that culture and technology dialectic.
Yeah, yeah. And, okay, so what would be a word that you could use for technology? I mean, Thiel used techne, right? They want to use that in critical context, techne. And apparently it is used in academia. But pets, are technology pets? What is technology today? Homeopathic, my term is, gets to the shrinking and tininess and friendliness of it, but it's a pretty obscure term. You know, maybe doesn't have a poetic resonance to be picked up. But the, you know, when they say in laws of media, we're now in an invisible terrain at the end of laws of media.
Yes.
Well, that's not a threat that it's invisible anymore. People want invisibility. They want things to surprise them. They look for it every day. They want the shock of the invisible becoming inaudible, becoming a figure. So what is the what would be the concern for an anti-environmental activity if it's not technology? If there isn't,
there'll be. I guess there'll be. I wonder if there'll be a new concern with living space. I suspect we'll like in the sense of, you know, how Marshall used to talk about each war is stemming from a different sense of being enclosed by something. By a new environment, and in the sense that like this seamless single resonating erotic erogenous zone. And as that shrinks, I'm wondering whether people will experience a sense of claustrophobia of sorts.
Yeah, I understand a lot of people are committing suicide now. It's okay. So I used to call my library and what I present on the radio I think that's the word. What do you call it when you analyze a corpse? Forensic?
Yeah, forensic analysis. Yeah.
Yeah, that I was doing forensic analysis or offering the figures of the corpse and the best analysis and analyses of the corpse. It was forensic information.
Yeah, so what McLuhan in that previous note almost of the quadrangular miasmas of the shape of right. The disease.
Yeah, and the... it's almost like the situation now is, will you be lucky enough to get your wits together to handle the massive die-off that's coming? And a lot of people are waiting to be part of that die-off. So it's what I partly talked about through the 90s is that the human body, the chemical body, is on the sidelines as the Android meme has a supernova. Now, the Android meme has become very tiny and friendly. And so you actually can't tell who is making erroneous moves that will lead to their suicide. You actually can't decide what's the correct action, what's right behavior.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. But that's, the absolute collapse of all points of view and hiked up to panic intensity.
Right, and then so everybody leaves everybody on their own. Even the, you know, tribal cultures in the Middle East that create the suicide bomber, that was an individual action for an icon, I guess, against the American icon. I could do an analysis or explain why one should... I could give a warning and think and lay out stuff that would sound purposeful, but I don't expect anybody to hear it.
No, I'll give it a crack, Bob.
Well, I did a little show with Eben Ray today, and I'm going to go back on her Wednesday night show on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And... but the, that's where, that is what is perverse or has a bad taste or smell to it of Mark Stallman's very, very late effort to decide to evaluate McLuhan's contribution. It's a little too late, Mark.
Yep. So back to the warning, Bob. What was the warning that you
I'm warning Mark Stallman. Mark, you keep wallowing around in the bog like that, could find yourself as a member of the massive die-off. How's that? I'm gonna use McLuhan. McLuhan was considered extremist. Well, I'm ending this little harmless purview of Marshall's garbage as a launch pad for a massive warning of the billions that will be killed by the failure to pay attention to McLuhan 60 years ago. Yep. I'm quite full of myself. Yeah, we're like two people. It's so quiet here. We're the last people on the planet. Getting ready to turn off the lights.
We're picking the best thing to analyze. We're doing a forensic study of the caretaker of the morgue. What do you call the guy in the morgues? What do they call the?
Oh, it's a mortician.
Yeah, the mortician. We are doing a forensic study of the last mortician, Marshall McLuhan. And actually, we did it a long time ago when I was on the radio in the 80s, and now we've chosen it as one of the best forensic studies done in the last 30 years. So we're reviewing it. But don't you find it odd that Mark Don Quixote Stallman shows up to carry the sword of McLuhan right when most of us knowledgeable graduates of the McLuhan landscape recognize McLuhan's irrelevance to our present. He should not be mentioned anymore. Should not be. We will gradually ignore him. He's not to be discussed. I'm watching this TV show called Downton Abbey. It's a aristocratic mansion in London during from 1912 to 1919. And the servants in that, when there was a problem, somebody became difficult, they would agree not to talk about him anymore. They'd ignore him or ignore the topic. That's where I'm at now. I'm the butler saying, we will not discuss that, Mr. Crystal, anymore. Consider it. You hear that kind of statement among the servants. They come to a point where they agree not to discuss it anymore or to forget it. You know what I mean? That was a common social strategy. Well, that's what I feel like saying. I think... somebody grab Croker's library, quick. Let's go through Croker's library.
To go and excavate it.
Yeah. Andrew, I think that famous line, we were first to break into that silent sea, that we've got to come up with a better statement of what's happening. We were the last to break into the afterimage of the noisy garbage dump. That's our new motto, the silent sea. Give me a break. And you know that quote that they used to say, a line or two before it has the furry brows or the furry something. That's where furry lint came from. They were predicting me and the great theatrical enterprise that we're still seeing unfold. You know, the furry brows?
Yeah.
I can quickly look it up. I won't bother. Okay, can you stop the recording and I'll go look up Muriel Bradbrook?
Okay, so we're on a pause now. Okay, we're resuming again after a quick break, talking about other things, squeaking, spitting, and now we're back with talking about Muriel Bradbrook.
Yeah, and I went out to my awesome library that will be forensically analyzed in about 500 years from now and brought out a key text of the defunct McLuhan Field by Philip Marchand, the biography, the first biography, page 53. It says, war, in fact, broke out just as the McLuhans settled in Cambridge in September 1939. They took lodgings near the university and settled down for a two-year stay, financed in part by a Canadian government bursary. McLuhan was now a research student at Cambridge, and the supervisor of his thesis on Thomas Nash was a young Elizabethan scholar named Muriel Bradbrook.
Ah.
Isn't that incredible? This is his supervisor. This is the woman who would learn what he found first, I assume, right? She'd keep up on what he was finding.
Yeah.
And is described as a very bright and agreeable junior member of the faculty who was responsible for guiding his academic work and reporting on his progress to the faculty board. Now, this is a missing element we found. We found the key in the, what is it, the little something in the haystack, the needle in the haystack. You never hear anybody talking about her, do you?
No, she would have taken quite a punt, I can imagine, actually, supervising him through with that dissertation.
What's a punt?
A punt, as in like a kick. Sorry, it's a colloquial phrase in the sense of kicking. So it's like a risky undertaking
to take on McLuhan.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And also, she's a woman. I mean, and she's the first woman. What did they say? The first woman in Cambridge on the faculty, Marshall. That now that's really interesting because you know the sculpture in the front of St. Mike's College where McLuhan is talking to the young student, the male and the female student. You know, it has all the historical figures.
Yes.
I always thought it was significant that he was talking to a young man and woman. He represented, McLuhan actually represented the women's, a figure of women's liberation or women entering the dialogue. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. I mean,
and when
he's got some pretty interesting things to say about women preachers, though.
He didn't like women preachers?
Hell no.
Okay, well, maybe that was just a cover story. But the when I met Margaret Atwood a few years ago in New York City, she had a reading, and I'd never tell you this story. I spoke to her. I asked her some pointed questions about McLuhan during her talk, and a fellow member of Finnegan's Wake Society, a woman, an older woman, she. And Margaret Atwood made a few like jokes in response to my points, and this woman after was quite proud as a 60s baby boomer, but even older than a baby boomer, women's liberationist, thought that I'd been severely or cleverly or something put in my place for having the gall to bring up McLuhan to an important novelist. And so she was quite happy with the outcome, but I thought she totally misinterpreted what was going on. Anyways, later, I caught her and her colleague, who was some professor, woman professor. They were doing books, a book on mythology or something. And I saw them just mingling around the Barnes & Noble bookstore, looking at the glossy stuff, glossy books in the front table. So I came up to her and finished the conversation that McLuhan failed to complete about what he said about her. Remember, he wrote about how the Canadian wilderness, the going out to be alone, was sparked by him reading her book, I think it's called Survivor, and the archetype of the natural hostile nature in North America. Do you remember that those ideas?
Yes.
And he also said to me that he said to a group of us that he couldn't read a page of Margaret Atwood. So,
yeah, just as an aside, Judith Fitzgerald, who's wrote an interesting an article, I think, McLuhan, not Atwood, and actually takes McLuhan up on, takes Atwood up on her refusal to examine McLuhan.
Oh, is that, you're saying there's an article where Judith,
yep,
who did a book, she did Wise Guy.
Yeah.
And she says Atwood should pay more attention to McLuhan?
Yep.
Well, she could have used my anecdote because, now how did this, there's something missing here. I'm talking to her and I bring up something about what she says about, whatever McLuhan was saying, I kind of tried to explain why McLuhan would, that she shouldn't take it personally, that he was a male chauvinist or something. Though I don't even know if that was what my agenda was. But I told her this point. So I'm trying to explain. I was asking if she understood a particular point of McLuhan's. I think maybe it was the whole going out to be alone and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think I pointed out what he had said about her, how she had inspired the Western, North American archetype of going out to be alone. And her response was, he's still a misogynist anyway. That's what her response was. Ridiculous. It was irresponsible. It had nothing to do with what we're talking about. And she said, well, regardless of what he said about, you know, figure of ground and that, he's still a misogynist. That's pretty rigid. And I'll have to tell Judith that or see if she knows that herself, that it's a limited approach to McLuhan.
Yeah, I guess she's, you know, public space. She had to...
No, this is private conversation.
Private conversation.
Yeah. This is with her and her friend sitting there, her professor friend. They did a book on mythology or something together, and I think the other woman edited it.
But it was just a conversation between me and her, basically. And she took it that way. Okay, so I think this is incredible. This is a well, Mark Stallman finds out that Mira Bradbrook, Richard Bradbrook's mother, Richard Barbrook's mother, was the biggest influence on McLuhan. Right? I mean, look, this is incredible. Okay, so it says, she herself was working on a book on Shakespeare and was immersed in the world of the Elizabethans. Even at the height of his career as a media guru, years later, McClure would frequently send Bradbrook urgent queries about arcane matters of Elizabethan literature, as if all the fuss about media was a distraction from the great work they had started together in 1939. Write an essay or a note on Mediacology. Forget Hilaire Belloc.
It's all Muriel.
Yeah, yeah. You know how Baudrillard wrote Forget Foucault in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Croker writes Forget Baudrillard in the late 80s. Well, that's forget Belloc. It's Bradbrook. I mean, this is something you missed, didn't you, Andrew? You don't remember this. You didn't even know who she was.
No, I didn't register it as necessary at the time.
You male chauvinist, you misogynist jerk, wouldn't even notice that the person he was talking to was not his mother, but it was Muriel Bradbrook all his life. That's incredible. Okay, it carries on. Well, you have to give Phil credit for noticing this, right?
Yes.
This could be the most important part of his book. Bradbrook's role, however, did not entail any close collaboration with or supervision of her student. She more or less stepped aside and allowed him to do his research on his own. It was a wise move. So there's your punting thing, right? She understood. But see, by doing that, would make her a colleague because she let him talk to her. McLuhan was past the point where he could usefully be supervised by anyone. In that regard, he was fortunate to be assigned Bradbrook as a supervisor, as he was later equally fortunate to obtain the help and critical judgment of F.P. Wilson when Bradbrook left Cambridge for war service in 1941. Now, it goes on to Wilson had been an Elizabethan scholar at the University of London when he was evacuated to Cambridge during the war. Bradbrook recalls, he was the best scholar of his generation. And then it says, this is not in quotes, but it says, the kind of professor trained in a meticulous Oxford style of literary scholarship who enjoyed arguing about the doubtful spelling of a word in one of Shakespeare's less important sonnets. McLuhan appreciated his good nature and his scholarly expertise. While not precisely sympathetic with McLuhan's intellectual flights, Wilson was generous and open-minded and was able to properly value the originality of McLuhan's thesis, for which he served as an examiner. Does that mean that Bradbrook was still the supervisor, is an examiner, a supervisor? Well, he didn't, I guess by 41 he didn't need supervising anymore. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know what the process would have been there, but supervisor is an odd category.
Okay, so it says that Bradbrook is also on page 54. So what's let me just read a little more. It says, since it's interesting, since Mark Stallman makes such a big deal out of his thesis, if there's no more research done by Andrew McLuhan, we will end on discussing the thesis. McLuhan began work on his dissertation by spending long hours in the rare books room of the Cambridge Library poring over the works of nationalist contemporaries. Corinne was usually by his side copying out long quotations. That's something the Evergreen said. Or McLuhan said through the evidence that Corinne was a major influence, not appreciated, not understood how much of an influence she was. Here he is, you know, taking all this information in when she's writing it out, right? She's
yeah.
Kind of a scholar in her own right by osmosis. Despite the inconveniences of wartime and McLuhan's initial dismay, standard for those beginning work on their doctoral thesis, at the amount of work he saw ahead of him, it was a pleasant year for McLuhan. So Mira Bradbrook says, we live pretty near the bone. They mean like food-wise, right?
Presumably.
Yeah. And then she says, but the sense of a really vivid, magnetizing intellectual life was enough to compensate for this. We were very, very unworldly, but also very sure of ourselves. My impression about McLuhan in particular was that he was very happy here and very much at home here. And we turn to page 54. It is possible, in fact, that McLuhan was never so happy again in his life. He did not have to deal with faculty animosities, dull students, or any of the usual academic routines. He can renew acquaintance with his old mentor, F.R. Leavis. In brackets, one of the first things he did, in fact, on arrival at Cambridge was to drop in on the Leavises for tea with his bride. Bracket. And most important, everything he studied was fascinating to him and could be absorbed in an unhurried and unpressured manner. In the evenings, he and Corinne relaxed by reading aloud to each other, Corinne knitting and McLuhan smoking his pipe while the other read. In the daytime, McLuhan frequently rode on his bicycle through the southern counties of England, memorizing important material for his thesis. Now, goes into the thesis, looking for, okay, so there's, Nash had enjoyed a mild vogue at Cambridge when McLuhan was an undergraduate. His high-spirited colloquial style, his indulgence in seemingly endless and pointless literary horseplay, and his appetite for words and puns made him very attractive to people like Empson and other new critics who were more interested in the way writers handled language than in their ideas. Ideas in quotes. No less a writer than James Joyce took Nash as a model. And Nash was congenial to McLuhan. As Muriel Bradbrook recalls, quote, McLuhan had an instinctive sympathy with the vivid, inconsequent, but very powerful style of Nash, and with Nash's impulse to be new, to be rhetorically arresting, to be, in fact, a sort of sociological journalist or journalistic sociologist. I couldn't help feeling that there was a Thomas Nash inside McLuhan dying to get out. There you go. She knew a lot about McLuhan.
Mm.
I find this pretty interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good.
A good discovery. I wonder if Eric, you should ask Eric on Mediacology. Ask him for any anecdotes about Muriel Bradbrook. It might be a scholar, and he might respond to the scholarly intent or the... finally, you'll say the secret key has been revealed. Andrew out there in New Zealand, with no help from Dobbs, found it on his own. This is what will be Eric's take on it, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to pursue that one, Bob. I'm hearing she's of interest, but possibly not of of tremendous significance.
Well, he kept writing her.
Yep.
And, Dobbs's high-spirited colloquial style, his indulgence in seemingly endless and pointless literary horseplay, and Dobbs's appetite for words and puns made very attractive to people like Andrew Crystal and other paramedia critics who are more interested in the way talkers handled media than in Bob's particular ideas. So the user becomes the content, a fitting way to end this maybe series. There'll probably be more stuff, but I don't know. I can't talk about McLuhan in a few weeks, right?
Yeah, that sounds a fair deal.
But this is quite an interesting find because I always thought it was significant. Whoever made that sculpture was important. But they had an insight into McLuhan because McLuhan's talking to the woman, to the young female student. Can you imagine that, having a female supervisor in the male chauvinist thirties?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, the war, I think, changed a lot of things. But I guess, yeah, pre-war, it might have been quite interesting.
Yeah. And maybe McLuhan realized that she would back off, be intimidated, and he would have more free rein. You know, maybe he realized he was at, they imply here, any other buddy would have been a problem. Any other male might have been a problem.
It's difficult today, Bob, connecting with this issue of gender. You know, it's these older concerns, these old ways of thinking are really foreign. So it's quite difficult.
You mean we shouldn't even bring it up? Or?
No, I'm not saying that we shouldn't bring it up. I'm just saying it's quite... It's difficult to
reconstruct. To remember, to know.
Yeah, to think back and shift your mind into this into that time when it was concerned.
Well, a good presentation of that is in this TV series I'm watching. Did I mention it? Downton Abbey? Did I mention that on the tape?
DOWNTONABBEY. Talk about fragmented, visually literate differences between the sexes. It's a good presentation of that. And that's still going a bit into the 30s, especially in a place like England. England's pretty feudal. America may not have been like that. But they say that the American women working in the factories during the war was the big breakdown of the old divisions.
Yeah, I think just out of necessity.
I think McLuhan was incredibly lucky. He always, you know, found and bumped into the most interesting or advantageous situations. And he did say that. He once said in an interview, what do you attribute to your, whatever they said, success or something? He said, luck. And then he explained it. He said, I've met a lot of very interesting people.
Yeah.
I mean, Muir Bradbrook is an interesting person to meet. The first woman faculty, you know, in that major university. And back then, Britain was still the king, right, in the 30s.
Yeah, well, wasn't that the project that essentially McLuhan set Kenner, was to go and meet the most interesting people of his day?
Oh, is that a quote?
No, it's not a quote per se, but like I actually got that from Scott Eastham, because Scott Eastham had a bit to do with Bucky and also with Kenner. Kenner was one of his teachers, and I think he recounts, like, because McLuhan took Kenner to go and see Pound, and I think that's sort of where it got started, and he just kept going from there on to the most, the interesting people of his time.
And Scott quotes Kenner saying McLuhan told him that.
Yes.
Well, that's more proof that I followed the correct path, because I am someone who did that to the max. I go to all the interesting people of our time.
Yeah, right? What a nice foundation for an education, and for somebody to tell you to do that. You know, don't worry about your courses, don't worry about anything else, just go and get in contact with the most interesting people of your time.
Well, what was interesting, I was forced to go meet the interesting people because I was told to go spy on them. It was part of my job. That's how I met McLuhan in 1954. I was assigned to spy on him because he was revealing the secret knowledge that the meeting was the message. He may not have understood that it was standard perception in the intelligence world, but we were curious about how he found out that the meeting was the message. And it turned out it was from Wyndham Lewis, you could say. Or maybe Gideon. Put a little plug in there for Gideon. What do you think?
Yeah, well, it's a necessary. Yeah, you know,
no,
I think
it was Hilaire Belloc. That's where he got it from. Okay, well, I'm sick of this. I've got movies to watch, TV series to watch, Android meme mind fuckings to do.
Yeah.
I have sex with the Android meme coming up tonight. I got another 6 hours to enjoy this day because I only sleep 3.5 hours a day, so that gives me 21 hours a day to play, Andrew.
And that's how the McLuhan centenary ended, not with a boom, but with a sigh.
No. It ends with Bob with great energy and a whirlwind of energy. And Bob was on to consume all four bodies. They whoosh.
Not excellent. I'm sure it'll be appreciated out there in the land. What was the quote? Bob's our favorite talk star. He's our Coronation Street.
Yes. Think of me as a rocket taking off now. I just, you know, boom out of Cape Canaveral.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Bob, and it's been a pleasure. So I'm just pushing stop now.